As your invisible, but certainly audible guide, I should like to welcome you to the Evoluon. May I begin by suggesting that you adjust the volume by using the round knob near the grip so that you can hear me clearly. Now I should like to tell you how I shall act as your host. We are going to take a stroll through a section of the Evoluon, and wherever necessary I shall direct you to the next point of interest, where we shall stop and have a look at the display. After each direction, you will hear this sound, which is the signal for you to use the red lever to switch off the Guidophone until you have arrived at the place indicated. You should then switch on the Guidophone again so that I can tell you about the things you can see. When the signal sounds again, switch off the tape. This will give you an opportunity to look at everything in your own time. When you are ready to hear about the next item of the tour, switch on the Guidophone so that I can tell you which direction to take. You should now take the lift in the dome to the balcony on the top floor. I shall keep quiet for a moment so that I won't disturb you on the way up. Therefore, please switch off your Guidophone until you step out of the lift. Having left the lift, you should turn right, repeat right, past the large black-and-white photograph of Peter Bruegel's painting. Behind this picture, you will be in a section of the balcony from which you can get a good impression of the size of the Evoluon's interior. You will see three circular galleries, and straight across from where you are now standing, you will see a balcony similar to the one you are on. From where you are standing, you can look down from a height of about 20 meters. The large dome above you, which spans the building, has an area of 5,000 square meters, about the same as a soccer pitch. Owing to the dome's extraordinary construction, it does not require any support. Its entire weight rests on the circumference of the lower bowl of the spheroid. Now you should go down the stairs opposite the balustrade. When you have done this, switch on your Guidophone again. At the bottom of the stairs, you will see a model of Stonehenge on your left, a prehistoric structure in the south of England comprised of enormous stones, which here forms the introduction to the subject measuring. It has been suggested that the builders of Stonehenge used it to determine exactly the start of each winter. The peculiarly arranged collection of stones could thus have been a kind of astronomical observatory, at which the orbits of heavenly bodies could have been observed so that the start and the end of the seasons could be determined. Continuing to the left, you will arrive at an Indian market scene, a picture which has remained the same for centuries. The scales and the stone weights and the abacus are the merchant's primitive aids. Their purpose is to ensure that both the buyer and the seller receive their due share. Accurate measuring, shown simply here in daily use, has always been at the cradle of all scientific activities. In the corner to the right of the merchant, you can see a representation of an ancient observatory. This diorama has brought us to a new era. Scientific research no longer serves a purely practical purpose, but is also carried out in the desire for knowledge, to fathom nature, knowing that the results may not be of immediate use in daily life. The globe in the scales represents the problem solved by Cavendish. By the way, have you ever thought about this problem? Cavendish's experiment, shown next to it, demonstrates clearly the point we have just made. He used an apparatus, of which you can see a small-scale model, to measure the mutual attraction between two masses, two spheres, for the first time. He used this knowledge to determine the Earth's mass. It was an exceptionally brilliant measurement for that time, but obviously he did not pursue it as something immediately practical in daily life. New apparatuses gradually came into being based on the ingenious but simple design of the merchant's scales, measuring equipment which enabled the mass and the weight of objects to be determined with increasing accuracy. When you continue, still keeping to the left and passing the protruding section, you will come to the department of measurements of length and distance. As with weighing, measuring length stems from man's practical needs. Merchants and street traders were the first people to use linear measures. Surveyors and architects of ancient palaces and pyramids also used them, a fact which has been revealed to us by ancient Egyptian inscriptions. Length was measured to establish the quantity of woven cloth, the dimensions of a house or a plot of land, the distance to the next village. In order to measure, we need a unit in which the quantity to be measured can be expressed. Today we use the meter as our unit of length, which is the same for everybody, everywhere in the world. Formerly, we used to use the thumb, the foot, the ell, the fathom, for everything we could span physically. This was very practical indeed, because everyone had measurements at his disposal. But as no two people are the same, the use of these units often led to disagreement. Here we see a cast from a Greek relief. Could this be an example of historic attempts to arrive at a standard for units of length? Attempts were made time and again during the centuries that followed to establish a standard for units of measurement. However, in most cases, they remained of only local significance. The proposal to derive the unit of length, the meter, from the Earth's dimensions stems from the time of the French Revolution. The meter was fixed at 1/40 millionth of the circumference at the equator. Here you can see an historic standard meter and a copy of the French standard, which is kept in Paris and from which all other standard meters are derived. The success of the French proposals to introduce unity to the system of weights and measures was not only due to Napoleon ordering that the new system should be adopted. The new system was particularly successful because the meter was not an independent unit, but part of a coherent system of weights and measures with the added practical advantage of decimal subdivision. The metric system has now been adopted in most countries. A very high degree of accuracy is indispensable for today's scientific research. This is why the wavelength of a spectral line of the inert gas krypton is now used as the standard unit of length. In this section, you will find a number of modern apparatuses for measuring length, which you can examine and often operate if you want to. Around the next corner, still keeping to the left, the measuring of time is dealt with. This too originated from practical needs. Fixing the duration of periods of time was very important in primitive agriculture. One had to know when the right moment for sowing had arrived, because at the best of times the harvest was subject to many uncertainties. It was not so important to know the exact time of day, because ancient man did not live so strictly to time, or so hurriedly as we do today. Therefore, the representation pictured here of how appointments were made and kept is probably not too far from reality. That part of the day when the sun is highest could not be determined to the very hour merely by looking at the sky. Therefore, man began to design instruments to measure time. The well-known obelisks were possibly used as early sundials. Historians have discovered that a number of practical measures were already in use in ancient times, such as the day for the period from sunrise to sunrise, the month for the period from full moon to full moon, and the year for the period from spring to spring. problem with which man struggled for centuries was caused by the fact that a year is not made up of a number of full days or months. The design of a practical calendar therefore presented tremendous problems. Julius Caesar ordered an improved calendar to be worked out. The leap year was put forward as a solution. Centuries later, another improvement appeared necessary, which came into use under Pope Gregory. There appeared to be too many leap years, and to overcome this, it was decided to drop three of them every four centuries. This Gregorian calendar is now used all over the world, despite the fact that many countries maintained Caesar's calendar, the Julian chronology, well into the 20th century. Apart from sundials, the ancient Greeks and the Romans also used water clocks. You will find a model of a water clock in the glass cabinet on your left at the beginning of this section. Time was measured by how long the water took to fill the vessel. As you can see from the models displayed here, the really accurate measurement of time was impossible until Christian Huygens made a mechanical clock with a pendulum or a balance wheel. You are now invited to follow the developments which led to modern timepieces, of which the electronic watch and the quartz clock are two examples. Then have a look at how the age of objects is determined by means of the radioactivity of carbon-14 found in nature. This method has only been used for a few years. What you have seen so far was restricted to a few practical applications of scientific research. Now I suggest you visit the section of the exhibition dealing more with scientific research itself. For many of us, work in a laboratory is surrounded by a veil of mystery. We do not often have an opportunity to go to look at it ourselves. You will find a hand pointing to the section, How a Scientist Works, on the glass pane next to the electronic clock. Walk across the passage, and when you have done so, please switch on your Gidaphone again. The section is introduced by a few examples of magnetism, shown on display panels. We have chosen magnetism because it lends itself well to explaining how scientific research takes place. How research proceeds is pictured on the illuminated yellow panels. They form a connected story which you can follow as you move past them. On the tables underneath are a number of models and experiments illustrating the story above them. You must be careful with these and other experiments. Some of the magnets on display are so strong that they could affect your watch if you held it too close to them. However, to begin with, I suggest you look at the first two illuminated panels and the models on the table in front of them. When you have examined them, switch on your Gidaphone again. What is being demonstrated here as a fundamental phenomenon of contemporary scientific research is the step-by-step approach to a problem, and how, in addition, specialists from other professional fields are successively called upon to try to find a solution to specific problems. In our example, research workers discover that there appear to be only two kinds of iron oxide, of which only one possesses magnetic properties. However, no difference can be detected chemically. The time has now come to engage the help of a crystallographer. The crystallographer's research reveals a difference in the shape of the crystals of both kinds of iron oxide. However, as the difference in the shape of the crystals does not explain the magnetic properties, the researchers are again obliged to call on the help of another expert, the theoretician. These days, scientific research is no longer the work of an individual. Now take a look at the remaining panels and demonstrations in this section and carry out the experiments. By this time you will have found out how many of the appliances you can operate yourself. You need not switch on your Gidaphone during your tour until you have reached the large model of a magnetic field with illuminated compass needles. This is behind the large rotating model of a computer's memory. In scientific research, observations always form the basis of further development. Careful observations and series of measurements made with the best instruments available at the time. Please now return to a section of the exhibition you have visited before. Opposite the sections Time, Length and Weight, you will find a row of niches containing experiments subdivided into three groups. Each group gives examples of laboratory work in the field of one particular unit of measurement. They are, in order of sequence, density, frequency, and temperature. You will see a red scale running along the full width of the upper edge of each stand, which indicates in which region some of the phenomena we can observe in nature belong. You can start the displays in the alcoves yourself by pressing the push buttons. Switch off the Gidaphone and have a closer look at everything. Although you have seen only a small part of the Evoluon, we have come to the end of this conducted tour. This is perhaps a good opportunity for a rest and an interval. If you want to explore the Evoluon on your own, please return the Gidaphone. You can then use the printed plan to guide you further. But if you have time, and if you are interested in another Gidaphone-conducted tour, you can have your Gidaphone fitted with a fresh cassette at no extra charge. I should like to thank you for your interest, and I hope you have an enjoyable day. Please remember to return the lever to the stop position. Thank you.